the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Good morning all. Thanks to Gemma and to Sarah and to Helen and to Peter for helping us so far with our morning's service. Right, we're starting a new series. We're based in the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. You've got it in front of you, I hope, Daniel chapter 1. Over 6 weeks, we're going to immerse ourselves in the stories that are contained in the first six chapters of the book. Now, many of the stories that we're going to read together are actually very well known because they're stories, I guess, that many of us will have heard from quite a young age. But the purpose of this series isn't simply to retell a good story. That would be great, of course, and that's what we are doing in one sense. But that's not all we're doing. Because instead, our aim is to just re-examine the stories in the light of what we know to be true about God, in the light of what we know to be true of ourselves, and in the light of the circumstances in which we find ourselves, both us and Daniel. And the stories that we're going to read in the first six chapters, they're all personal stories. They're all stories that have people just like you and I within them. And some of the chapters are quite lengthy. And I think at best, Johnny and I are only going to be able to scratch the surface of what these stories have to teach us. Now, if you'd like to dig a bit deeper into this part of the Old Testament, I'd recommend this book. This is John Lennox's book, Against the Flow. It's not short, I warn you, but it is immensely helpful and it is very, very readable. It's a great book if you'd like to dig a bit deeper. And also, I'd ask you one other thing as this series starts. It would be hugely helpful to Johnny and to I if you could find the time to read ahead and familiarize yourself week on week with the next part of the story. You'll see why I say that when you get into chapter 2, because it is pretty long, and Johnny's got to deal with that one. So since this is the start of the series, let's just have a go at placing ourselves into our right place in history. Just put Daniel into some sort of historical setting. Well, the events take place roughly 600 years before the birth of Christ. We see from verse 1, chapter 1, Jehoiakim is the king of Judah, and Judah is the southern kingdom of a divided Israel. And the nation of Judah has endured a century or more of oppression and aggression from the Assyrian Empire, who had overrun the northern kingdom some years earlier. But that now wasn't the extent of it. That wasn't all that was happening, because Judah was coming under huge pressure from their southern neighbor, that of Egypt. Egypt now saw the opportunity, now that the Assyrian Empire was beginning to lose its grip on power in the Middle East, it saw a chance to apply both political and military pressure onto Judah themselves. And in fact, the then Pharaoh, Necho, had a hand in putting Jehoiakim onto the throne. And he did it with that very intention. He was planning to make Judah a vassal state. But there was a new kid on the block. There was a new superpower in play, and it was the Babylonians. And in a turbulent decade that saw King Nebuchadnezzar's war machine just sweep across the whole nation like a swarm of locusts, Egypt was defeated and pushed back, and the nation of Judah was invaded. Look at verse 2, if you would. In verse 2, we see what appears to be a really curious comment about God's part in delivering his people into Nebuchadnezzar's hands. But as we saw from our evening series, if you were with us in the book of Habakkuk, a series that in fact was meant to be a curtain raiser for this series in Daniel, these events were prophesied by a whole succession of God's spokesmen. You see, the people needed to change their ways. The people needed to turn back to God if they wished to avoid calamity. But the people stubbornly refused. They refused to reform, and so the nation reaped the harvest that they had sown through their own willful disregard of God. And the harvester of that harvest was a pagan king, Nebuchadnezzar. Right, we're going to think about this in four, under four headings. We're going to look at the context, we're going to look at the issue, we're going to look at the threat, and we're going to look at the hero. So here's the first thing we're going to look at this morning. The context is exile. Now here, it isn't explicitly told within the story. Not all the details are there, but we do learn from other places in the Old Testament that in order to just ensure that Jehoiakim submitted to Babylon authority, Nebuchadnezzar embarked upon a systematic program of deportation. And it's most likely that Daniel was among, along with his friends, of course, that we read of in verse 6 and others, were amongst the first to be forcibly removed from their home city of Jerusalem. And this Babylonian king was really shrewd. He was really clever. He was as much a politician as he was a military strategist. Since he took into exile over several years, in several waves, the brightest and the best that the nation of Judah had to offer. He took the politicians, he took the leaders, he took the artisans, he took the teachers, he took those with fine legal minds, he took those from noble families. Why did he do it? Well, he did it to ensure that the capitulation of Judah was assured. What he did was he removed their leadership. He took from the nation of Judah everything that was necessary for it to run, putting, of course, his own people in place. So Judah became critically weakened by this policy of enforced exile of everyone who was anyone within Judah. Now, almost certainly, Daniel and his friends would have been in training for religious or government service in Jerusalem. So they were expecting to gain employment. They were going to serve the people of God in the city of God. And there really was no higher calling than that, was there? This is what they were going to do. But instead, without warning, they find themselves 1,000 miles from home. They're away from everyone that they love. They're away from everything they rely on. They've been deported to a pagan, Gentile enemy state. Just think what it would be like. Everything that surrounded them was unfamiliar. There was a strange language. There was a strange culture. They had no idea what they were doing. And worst of all, for Daniel and his friends, the place was absolutely littered with gods and idols. Now, I'm sure that there are many of us who maybe even today can associate very acutely with those kinds of experiences. In this story, which in some senses has a sort of an echo of the story of Job, we find here someone whose life has been turned upside down. We find here someone whose hopes and their dreams have been shattered. Every single prop has been kicked away. And we don't have to suffer physical deportation to associate with what Daniel feels and he has to deal with. But however and wherever you find yourself this morning, I think we can take some comfort from this story. We find encouragement in it because chapter 1 reveals that God hasn't in any sense forgotten Daniel. Physically, Daniel is far removed from God. He is removed from the temple in Jerusalem. He is removed from the people of God in the place of God. And yet, relationally, God is right there with him. And intriguingly, I think there's something more going on in our story, because God is using this situation to bring about change, in order to transform Daniel and his friends. Even within a seemingly hopeless situation, maybe the situations of the kind that you find yourself in, take heart, because God is at work. Gerard Kelly, in his book Stretch, writes this. He says, "The greater truth is that exile may be the road to liberation. What seems at first a terrible loss may prove to be a great gain." So is it possible that for Daniel, his exile is going to be his exodus. So in whatever situation we find ourselves in, whether we're confidently embracing faith, or whether we're merely just clinging on to something that we actually don't really understand and don't really get right at this moment, the experience of Daniel reveals one thing. God is in our story. Even in times of exile, God is with us. Even when we feel lost, even when we feel disorientated, God is there. And in amongst it all, there's the chance that exile becomes exodus. You know, I find this a great comfort. I take great heart in this because even when I may feel defeated, even when I may feel spiritually detached from God, God remains faithful. Which rather brings us on to our second point for this morning, the issue. Well, the issue, I think, is faith. That's the issue. The context is exile, but the issue is faith. Some of the detail at the beginning of the chapter just hints at the fact that the victory of Nebuchadnezzar is more than merely a political or military victory. Look at what we read in verse 2. We read that articles from the temple of God were removed and rehoused in the treasure house of a pagan god. Now, the implication is that the God of Israel, not only the people of Israel, has been subdued. That's what Nebuchadnezzar thinks he has done. He has subdued not only the people, but he has subdued the God of Israel as well. And I think one of the primary questions that Daniel has to get to grips with, one of the questions that resurfaces time and time again throughout the first half of this book is this one. Is it Israel that has lost power, or is it the God of Israel that has lost power? Is the God that the people of Judah worship merely a local deity? Is he like the gods of the nations whose influence is thought to be constrained to geography? Or is he, as Daniel has always believed to be true, the one true God? Is he the only God? That is the question. That is the main question, I think, through the early part of the book of Daniel. So can Daniel's faith actually survive exile? Can he survive the time of being removed? Can God still reach him? And can Daniel still reach out to God? Is it even possible? A couple of years ago, whilst I was still at that time in secular employment, I took the decision to step away from the leadership team here at Belmont Chapel. There was a whole host of reasons why I did that. And in doing so, whether consciously or unconsciously, what I did was I scraped away something of the veneer covering my spiritual life. And in doing so, I uncovered what lay beneath. You know, so often I think we're led to believe by society that what we do, what we achieve, is the sum total of our worth. It is who we are. And that's actually not a view that's restricted to secular society. Unfortunately, it even finds its way here into these four walls. But the question that I had to face up to during that period was whether or not my faith in God was indivisibly woven into the very makeup and the DNA of my life, or was it merely clothing that I was wearing? For me, I discovered God to be more real than I'd probably ever experienced him before. And what I learned in that time of temporary self-imposed exile was that God was wanting to realign my life and to recalibrate it. I discovered that God is much more in the being than he ever is in the doing. Everything that Daniel was doing for God in the city of God, in amongst the people of God, surely the place where he should be working, was stripped away. It was taken away totally. But what Daniel discovers is that he is known and loved by God, even in times of exile. And because he gets to realize that, God takes on for him a new and startling reality. Which brings me on to the third point. The third point is the threat. The threat is assimilation. So it's clear from the story, Nebuchadnezzar takes the brightest and the best from Judah. But he doesn't take them just so that he can stick them in a dungeon somewhere. He takes them in order to use them. He wants to use their skills and their talents. He is not going to let them go to waste. He is, as I said, politically very shrewd. So he starts a program of assimilation. He starts this program of getting these young influencers immersed into the culture of Babylon. He instructs them in the culture and the thinking of their new masters. And the plan is to get them to forget where they came from. His plan is simply that, to immerse them so deeply into the culture of their captivity that it would over time become their own culture. That's what he looks to do. But for Daniel and his friends, there is a line to be drawn in the sand that they wouldn't, as the story tells us, step over. It's interesting to see what they said yes to. They say yes to a pagan education in verse 4. They say yes to a political career in the back half of verse 5. They say yes to a change of name, which is interesting. But they say no to the king's food in verse 8. Now, in many ways, when you look at it at first glance, especially when you look at those names and see what they actually mean, you would have probably been tempted to think that that was the place they draw the line. Because their names were removed from them and they were given new names. The names they had, their birth names, were all to do with God. And the names that they were given were all to do with pagan gods. But Daniel says, no, we can live with that. That's not where we're going to draw the line. Where we're going to draw the line is our choices from King Nebuchadnezzar's menu and his wine list. That's where we're going to draw the line. At first glance, you probably think, why? Why? Why would you do that? But there's rather a lot more to it. Because in ancient times, sharing food, and in this case, as it actually says, the food of the king, was tantamount to swearing a covenant allegiance to the provider. So these four young Jews had decided they would and they could serve Nebuchadnezzar and his state. Indeed, actually, they would do it to the best of their ability. And we discover that they have plenty of ability and they do apply themselves to learning. They would accept all of the adjustments that the government required in order for them to be trained. But they would not give to Nebuchadnezzar or his state the ultimate loyalty and commitment of a covenant promise agreement. They would not share bread with this man. They would not do that. That kind of covenant relationship was reserved for God alone. You know, we live in a culture that would love to assimilate us. Absolutely love to. It's a culture that would love to have us as Christians say yes to absolutely everything. We have this culture that would just love to entice us and romance us. But where do you and I draw the line? Where should we draw the line? You see, the danger is that in always saying yes, in embracing every single trend and social norm, we end up fitting in to such an extent that we are indistinguishable from those around us. That is what Nebuchadnezzar wanted to do with Daniel and his friends. He wanted to make them look like Babylonians. So they were so immersed in the culture that they became the culture. They became the people. So what is it that marks you and I out as Christians? Where do we draw the line? What speaks to other people that we have made a covenant agreement with God? through the death of Christ. The thing that we remember as we share bread and wine, as we're going to do so in a few moments. Where do we draw the line? What makes us different? You know, in a week or so, there's an initiative across the city which has been taken up by several churches, and we've been invited to join in, called Joy Fest. And it's an idea which is very, very simple, is that over the few days of the week from the 3rd through to the 10th, you just do an act of kindness for somebody. And when you've done that act of kindness to them, you say why you've done it in the fact that you are a member of a local church in Exeter, and you hand them one of these cards, and there's loads of them out there on the thing to take. There's also an app for your phone. Isn't exciting? If you want to just download that one as well. But that's the idea of a week. What is going to identify us in this city as being different from those that we meet with every day? Maybe this is a way that we could do it. It's just simply called Joy Fest. Do something, hand them a card, and say that you just want to, as the logo says, get ready to make Exeter smile. There are ways that we can, really little ways, in which we can show that we are different from those around us. So that brings us to my final point for this morning, the hero. And the hero, whilst of course ultimately it's God, in this chapter we see something wonderful about Daniel, don't we? Daniel's decision to honor God, even in exile, reveals something about Daniel's faith. It reveals something about the God that Daniel worships. And the outcome of the story, if you read in verse 15, the fact that despite the reduced diet, despite going vegetarian for a period, this is what it says. Daniel and his friends looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the king's food. And this was confirmation that Daniel's faith was able to endure even the toughest of setbacks. It was a faith that was so solidly rooted in God, and who we discover, of course, is a God who isn't constrained by geography, who isn't a God who is limited by degree. This is a God who keeps his covenant relationship. This is a God who is faithful. This is a God who can be trusted. This is a God who travels with us, even into times of exile. This is a God who promises never to leave us and never forsake us. Now, there's an old hymn from my childhood, and it's from it that I took the title for this series. If you're old enough, and believe you me, you've got to be fairly old, there's a chorus that poses a question in this. It's kind of a children's hymn, children's song, however you want to look at it. And the question is simply this: dare to be a Daniel? Question mark. You know, I think as we go through the stories over the next few weeks, we are going to see challenges coming time and time and time again. Do we dare to be like Daniel? What does following Jesus look like for us today? There was within Daniel's faith and his experience an element of risk-taking. I'm risk-averse. I'm probably risk-averse not only in life, but with my faith as well. But I shouldn't be. So do we have this desire to take on the challenge of being a Christian in a secular and sometimes hostile society? We're going to accept that challenge, or we're going to shrink back? That's the question. Are we going to be so immersed in culture that actually nobody can see us as anything different than everybody else around us? The pagan king wanted to do that with Daniel and his friends, and they said no. They said no. And what was the basis for saying no? It wasn't just being stubborn. It was the fact that they serve and worship a living God.